Hi, I'm Charles McGonigal from Apple Tree Winery in Burlington, Wisconsin, and you're listening to Cider Chat.
Episode number 83. Well, hello and welcome to a Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Wincoller, and I am the producer and the cider MC of this weekly cider-centric podcast, where we speak with makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we are with Charles McGonigal of Apple Tree, a cidery in Wisconsin. There'll be more on that chat in just a moment. In my spot of Ciderville, it has been raining and raining, and guess what? Today it is raining again. But I do believe I'm hearing that the sun's going to come out tomorrow. And wow, I think we're all going to like just crawl out of our like little hovels where we've been protecting ourselves and sit like turtles out on a rock or a muskrat on a log. Wow, it has been a deep soak. However, we know that rain is just the thing to kind of get the soil all loosened up and juicy for a fruit-forward fall, which I'm hoping for. So there's always a bright side in even the grayest day. And I suspect if you're having a great day like I am, that your spot of Ciderville, you're just the kind of person who knows how to find the bright light in the dreary. At least I hope you do, and hopefully this podcast will kind of keep you just rolling right along. So glad to be back here every week. Wednesday is when I release the podcast, and I'm talking to you in, well, it's June of 2017, and this is my wedding month. I announced that last week, first time I kind of announced it on Cider Chat, and I'm stoked, super happy for that. And what I have figured out is that I'm going to have a podcast release, obviously this one, this week. And then next week, a little added bonus, I'll talk about that in a moment. And then I'm going to be off for 2 weeks because I'll be on my honeymoon, and I just want to like kick back and, you know, enjoy myself, as one would suspect. So I will be back the first week of July now. So that's kind of a little switch there. You never know in Ciderville. It's always kind of changing up. You know, it's like podcasters are like farmers and cider makers. You know, we kind of move with the flow. In Ciderville, it's all about flexibility. But it all sounds good. I'm excited about that because I thought, ooh, this would be my last one for a while. And you could tell, maybe, I don't know, I hope you could tell that it is just really hard for me not to be hanging out with you every week. I just so enjoy it. And if you enjoy it too, and if you get a lot of value from this podcast, and you feel that it's giving you info and connection around the world, then I would really hope that you would think, you know, this would be a great thing to support. Imagine if like everybody out there in Ciderville listening, and there are a lot of people, just gave $1 a month, it could really make this side of Ciderville, my little spot here, with the Medlars, Mr. Quince, Perry Pear, and Apple, who occasionally makes, you know, it into the studio. Apple's very, very busy though, of course, to make life a little bit easier. And kind of start ramping things up in the direction I'd like to do. And I do think that Cider Chat, this podcast, really helps Ciderville. That's my mind. And I know that the folks who are joining in on Patreon, that is a page that content providers like me go to have people sign up like you. You could go to Patreon. There's a link to that on the show notes, or just Google Cider Chat Patreon, spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And that is a little spot that gets a lot of value. And one of the things that I'm going to be adding to that spot coming up is a short transcript of this larger chat that we're having today with Charles McGonigal. And that's going to be specifically on making Perry. And how do you deal with pears? Look, I'm always trying to figure out how to deal with Perry Pear. I mean, Perry Pear is some character. And what we're going to find out from Charles is that pears are also in their own way, wherever they are around the world, whether they're here with me in the studio or with you in your orchard, they have their own particularity in making that drink, that libation, that delicious perry. So I'm going to be taking that snippet that you'll be hearing at the tail end of today's chat and getting that transcribed, and that's going to go to the patrons who have been amazing in supporting Cider Chat. And you could join too at Patreon, the Cider Chat page for Patreon. I know that just listening to this, I've been taking notes along the way, and I thought, you know, I really got to get this transcribed because there's so much value. And thinking about making perry and all the particulars of it, Charles is a key person in the U.S. on this topic. The last podcast episode that I had transcribed was with Neil Worley on Keeving, and because there was just so much value there. And wouldn't you know, like a whole group of American cider makers just went over to see Neil and learn about Keeving. If you can't do that, and a lot of people can't do that, just getting that transcript from Neil is amazing. And you might not need the transcript. Maybe you want to be convinced by just listening to his episode. So just go to episode number 26, and you'll get to find details of that cider making technique called keeving. Well, this week we're going to be talking about making perry, and there's a lot of particulars. So we're going to get right into this chat. This is a long chat this week, and I'm so thrilled to bring to you Charles McGonigal, who I met at CiderCon. And so a big tip of the glass to the United States Association of Cider Makers, who were so gracious in setting me up and really helping me be able to bring these episodes forward out to all of you out there in Ciderville. I met Charles last year at the Portland CiderCon, and we didn't really have a chance to record. So when I was heading back to the Chicago CiderCon this past February, it was on the top of my list to be able to sit down and have a chat with him. And I could have just sat there all day just chatting with the guy, because like myself, we really love to kind of get into it. And he is just kind of like a basket full of info and has a fun way of speaking about cider. So it's really my pleasure to be able to grab a glass right now and join this chat with Charles McGonigal of Appletrue Winery in Wisconsin.
My cidery is in southeast Wisconsin, about an hour north of Chicago. I am a transplanted Michigander.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I grew up in southern Michigan, also up by the Traverse City area, and I'm a survivor of the UP. So, a bit of...
A survivor of the...
UP, the Upper Peninsula.
Oh, okay, that's cute. Yeah.
I ended up in southeast Wisconsin by a historic happenstance. And I work with a grower of antique apples. I'm partnered with Brighton Woods Orchard, where Appletrue is located on their orchard. And they grow about 200 varieties of apples and pears, some of which are specifically just for me.
How many percentage of those are apples versus pears?
It's about 90% apples.
Okay.
And they have some modern apples. The new Pizzazz apple is a successor to Honeycrisp, is out of Wisconsin, so they're a grower of that. But they also have Lady Apple.
Mm.
They have, you know, all the classic russets.
Mm-hmm.
The specific orchard that my family planted in 2005 is an extra 2005 is an extra 3 acres of traditional English Perry pears and then Anglo-Franco bitters.
Very nice.
The classic bitter sharps and bittersweets.
Very nice. And how long has Appletrue been open for commercially?
We started in 2001.
And is that
like when you started making cider, or how long has your career been in cider making?
I started making mead under my desk at Michigan Tech in about 1991.
Was that a desk in your dorm room?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, a quirk of the rules were that as long as you were of age, you could have as much alcohol in your dorm room as you wanted, so long as no one container was bigger than a gallon. Just to keep out kegs. And so I had a row of fermentation jugs. There was a great co-op across the lake in Hancock, and I would go over. I started making fruit wines, but in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, berry season is about 3 days long. So we went to the co-op, we'd get honey, there's a small group of us, and we would make mead down in the kitchenette and then ferment it in our rooms and discovered that mead is an acquired taste.
Yeah. Sure.
So I liked the sizer, the apple mead, best. So yeah. I simply dropped the honey and started working on a bottle fermented cider that became our first product, our Appley Brut.
Nice. What did you go to school for?
Biochemistry.
Biochemistry, which I'm sure has come in very handy with your cider making.
It's good for troubleshooting. You know, cider making is science and art, mm-hmm. and I like to try to keep both in mind always.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You opened Apple True. Was it you that opened that?
Or yes.
That was not a family business?
It was not an existing business. I wanted to... My career has been in petrochem research. Petrochemistry.
Petroleum. Okay, right.
I work for a company that designs refineries. I'm on the research side.
Okay.
And while sometimes we dabble in green space, we developed, and I actually have a small amount of time charged to the project that developed the jet fuel from biosources. Yeah, as a biologist in a petrochem company, I'm looking at about three glass ceilings. And so in order to try to improve the lot of my family, we looked at our skills. You know, my wife has a degree in chemical engineering from the same university. She also does all our label artwork. And we put our skills together, and I was getting some awards in non-commercial competition for my ciders, and we decided to see what we could do. Mm-hmm. It looked so good on paper that we shopped around for some vulture capital. It was during the tech boom, so that didn't find any. Mm. But we ended up partnering, making an arrangement for using the barn at the orchard that we are at now.
Okay.
For a certain number of years in exchange for the site improvements.
All right,
so,
nice.
And that got us our start.
Wow, that's a great story, and especially pulling in the two skills there. And the labels that Charles is talking about, and your wife's name is?
Melissa.
Melissa. It's just a beautiful presentation. This one here, the Americana Still Cider, it's a single barrel series, and it's this... I'm counting. That looks like quince, I'm going to say, but is it?
No, it is Hughes Virginia Crab. Okay. It is Harrison. It is Albemarle Pippin, mm-hmm. Winesap, and one of the candidates for the apple, Tolliver. So these are all Jeffersonian apples. The Hughes grafted straight from Monticello.
Beautiful. And is that like a painting that she did?
Five different watercolors that then I assembled in the computer.
Lovely, lovely, lovely label. Let's talk about the name of the winery and the spelling, because you have an interesting spelling there.
Our spelling is the letter ash, which looks like an A and E joined together, mm-hmm. PPELTREOW. We pronounce it Apple True. Mm-hmm. When we were writing the business plan and thinking about starting a business, I wanted a name that was a little pretentious and not French. And since I happen to have an interest in Middle and Old English, the name is Apple True in Anglo-Saxon, Old English. Nice. And it can be read either Apple Tree or Apple Truth. They used the same word for both.
Very nice, very nice. Yeah, it really stands out.
Yeah, we have a terrible time with people pronouncing it. It's not the letter ash that gives them the trouble. It is the fact that they don't know what to do with the silent O.
Oh.
Right. And every time somebody has problems with the silent O, I want to subpoena them.
Well, I'm glad that I know what to say before I met you. Appletrue Winery. And not called a cidery.
When we started, there are precious few, if any, cideries.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew we wanted a certain tourist trade, and we wanted a name that people would recognize, have some anticipation of what to get when they were getting mm-hmm. when they were walked in.
Mm-hmm.
So cider is a kind of wine. Cider is not a kind of beer. When pressed, I, of course, will play the devil's advocate, and I have a whole presentation on how it is a wine and not a beer, or it is a beer and not a wine. I can argue it both ways. But you have to have a winery permit in order to make it. Every so often in our wine tasting room, we do get a person who says, "How can you call it a winery? There are no grapes." But we're in a state with, you know, a long winery tradition, but not a long grape growing tradition. And there are plenty of meaderies and things where people are making fruit wines, and
mm-hmm.
so we only have a very few people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, those people. Anyway, well, let's talk about this cider and just the presentation. So this is in a 750 ml bottle. It's clear. It has it's corked.
Yes.
Correct? And then it's kind of capped with a nice little red plastic covering. That beautiful label, it says Americana Still Cider, Single Barrel Series.
We make some ciders year after year. But I reserve some space on the winery tasting sheet. You know, I only have so much space on a tasting guide. So I preserve myself some real estate for experiments.
Mm-hmm.
They can be single varietal experiments.
Mm-hmm.
They can be cellar treatment experiments. It varies. Melissa says that these are the ciders where the cider maker plays. Right? And that's quite true. The other thing is that we say is that they're always interesting and sometimes they're good. In this case, Americana is just starting to grow from the single barrel, which is one of my steel barrels. I like steel. All right. I only use plastic for short term.
Steel barrels.
Steel. Yeah, they look like drums.
Yeah.
55
yeah.
gallons, about 20 cases.
So when you say barrel, you're talking about a steel barrel.
Yes.
Say more about that. Why do you like working with steel?
It is as impervious to oxygen as the quality of your seal. And of course, you don't want it to leak, so the seal is pretty good. I have watched Perry brown in a high-density polyethylene IBC, mm-hmm. intermediate bulk container.
Mm-hmm.
I have put it in there because I ran out of tank space, and over the course of a week, I have watched it brown from the top down, from the oxygen diffusing through the plastic,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which isn't fast, but Perry happens to be especially delicate.
Sure.
Steel doesn't scratch. Right, or at least it's very hard to scratch, so you know, I don't have to worry about creating habitat in an IBC, extra surface area that I don't mean to. Steel is infinitely reusable. I use oak barrels. I use Wisconsin oak barrels for my spirits.
Wisconsin oak.
Because we are a distillery also.
Right.
And barrels are a whole new thing. But 15 years in and having a certain reputation for being the chemist in the room when in a gathering of cider makers, I don't know how to make barrel-aged cider. I don't actually know everything. I just have the reputation for seeming like it.
He said, I mean, if you were here right now sitting across from Charles, he has this kind of like little whimsical, devilish look there, you know, which is just absolutely priceless.
I smirk.
You got a good smirk, too. So, but steel, and I have to say, I haven't tried your ciders yet, so I'm excited to try them. What do you notice in terms of what it might lend to the cider in the taste profile?
Well, I'm trying to minimize the oxidation, so I'm trying to retain a floral aroma.
Right.
I put it into a barrel. It'll blow the floral aroma away. It'll just oxidize it away. And then you also have to be triply careful of managing sulfites to avoid, wild lactic acid bacteria.
Right.
While that's important for certain world styles of cider, I call myself a ciderista terroirist. Right? I want to express cultivar and land, not cellar. So I do fairly, not completely controlled, but fairly well controlled fermentations.
How big are these barrels?
55 gallons.
55 gallons.
23 inches by 32 inches, roughly.
And probably quite a bit heavier than an oak barrel.
Oh, no, much lighter.
Lighter, okay.
Oh, barrels.
What's the thickness of it?
Less than a 1/16 of an inch.
Okay. And it's round, kind of like looks like you're a steel barrel, like a flat top, flat bottom.
Flat top,
flat bottom.
So it stacks
really easily.
Yep.
Do you stack it or do you have them on their side?
Do I have them on their end? Yeah. When I'm using them as fermenters, they are flat end up and down.
Okay.
But I do load them onto barrel racks and stack them. See, I can only go, four in a stack. I can put three high for six barrels in a stack.
Interesting.
Empty, but I don't try that full. It's just so heavy. But they load right onto regular wine industry barrel racks.
Do they rust?
No, they're stainless.
Oh, they're stainless steel. I'm sorry, stainless steel. Okay, yeah.
And when push comes to shove, they actually cost less than oak barrels. And oak barrels you can really only use a few times if you're looking for barrel character, and then you have to sell them on. Steel lasts forever.
Right, okay. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the stainless there, and I was thinking steel, and I was just trying to wrap my head around that. So I'm glad I kind of qualified
stainless.
That. It's very, very different, isn't it, than just purely steel?
Mild steel?
I was like, wow.
Yeah, cider dissolved.
He is like way out of the box here. I mean, steel. Yeah. Cool, so that's what you're using? You're using that to condition
steel tanks, steel barrels for small sizes.
Well, I'm certainly happy that we finally figured out that AppleTru is using a stainless steel. Part of my dilemma is that I knew that beer had at one time been canned in steel cans. 1935, Pabst was the first, really large brewery that had first tin cans and then it went into steel cans. And I knew there was a number of different breweries, and I spoke to someone who once had a can from a Pittsburgh brewery. I'm not really sure what that one is right now off the top of my head, but he talked about how heavy that six-pack of steel cans was. And then it was in 1958 that the Hawaii Brewing Company introduced the first all-aluminum beer cans. Now that cider is being canned, well, cans have taken an even further evolution to really make that container work with the cider, because you have to balance off what the properties of cider are in terms of the acidity and how that melds well with the aluminum can. They had that figured out, and now we have it figured out exactly what AppleTru is doing. So let's get back to this chat with Charles McGonigal of AppleTru Winery.
Getting back to this Americana, the still cider, it's a blend of all the apples that are on the label, correct?
Yes.
And is there like a percentage that you're doing in with each one?
No, I tend to do orchard run. I don't have so many that I can do a ratio blend at this point.
Sure.
So it will vary a little bit year to year, but it will be the Hughes Harrison Winesap Albemarle, some Tolliver. This particular year also has some, possibly, Campfield and some Granny Winkle. But it is specifically the Colonial American, cider apples of reputation. What I've learned is that they're not tannic.
Yeah.
The American cider apples have never been like the European cider apples.
And this is 7.5%?
Roughly. It's not chaptalized. They run slightly higher bricks.
And are you using You're a terroirist, so are you using the local yeast on the apples?
No, or? Our local yeast is not interesting.
Okay, so you
tried
pitching,
it.
You're
that was a different yeast.
And in terms of the ciders that you make, is that true across the board? You are introducing the yeast.
Yes. Caveat: I don't sulfite before I pitch, so I allow a competitive fermentation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's where I
right.
say it's not perfectly controlled.
And why do you do that?
I got tired of accidentally sticking fermentations but not waiting long enough after I sulfited in order to pitch. I tend to I dry pitch. I don't do a rehydration. I dry pitch on cider at about 30 to 5 degrees F, and I just let it warm up and start.
Yeah. I have to admit that's the way I make most of my ciders, too. And I like the play between the natural yeast and the yeast that I'm sometimes introducing. And I think it creates its own little yeast culture.
It works for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a still. Why did you choose to make that a still?
This is not a big seller for me. Actually, of the series, it does the best. It's lovely. A little hint of cherry. All my single barrels are completely dry. Zero residual sugar. If I sweeten other things I make, but not my single barrel reserves.
Okay.
I do draft style with them, with just petalant. I started by doing full champagne method sparkling, riddled and disgorged the whole bit.
Yeah.
I still think there is a place in the cider world for a simple, still cider. And they're rare. They are not easy to find. I mean, if you can dig up some Olivers, that's great. Mm-hmm. But on the broader market, ones that aren't apple wines.
Yeah.
Sure, there's apple wine, but it looks like an apple wine, but it's a cider at heart. It is unchaptalized. It is
so
just the apples.
Fermented dry, no filtering?
It is filtered.
It is filtered, okay.
Yeah.
Are you filtering for clarity or for stabilizing?
Given no residual sugar, I'm not so much worried about stabilizing. It is for clarity.
Okay, great. And the clarity is brilliant for people?
I have not had success with, in my local market, I have not had success with cloudy ciders.
Kind of cloudy, yeah.
I have, and it's a problem with...
This is incredibly, just for folks to know, because we're on this kind of audio, this is a beautiful, deep golden, I would say. It's not, is that how
it's
you...
It's a lovely color.
We're in a room, so the light kind of reflects in a way, but it's a deep golden hue, absolutely brilliant clarity.
Yeah. Pear likes to chill haze. And it's very hard to keep it from doing so. So you put your Perry in a refrigerator
Let's talk about chill haze, for folks who don't know what that means.
Well, as I was going to say, if you put your Perry in the refrigerator too long, it can come out hazy, right? It started clear, but it comes out hazy. In beer, it's usually associated with protein.
Mm-hmm.
In Perry, it's probably pseudopectins.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it's very challenging to try to keep it from doing that. And I had an interesting conversation a few years ago with a purveyor in northwest Wisconsin on the path to Minneapolis, and explaining, I had a sample bag with me and it had ice in it, and the Perry got over chilled and it was cloudy, and I was being apologetic. And she stopped me and she said, "How come it's okay for all these wild fermented Oregon Pinots, Pinot Noirs, to be cloudy and yours not to be?" And I said, "We're not in Oregon. In my local market, things need to be clear." My experience.
Yeah, and you have to play to your market for sure. So that's lovely. So that's a still cider, and you have probably every year it's a different kind of single barrel series, or is there other barrel series?
The other one I've started doing more routinely I call Antique Russet. And that one is a single varietal, but which russet changes from year to year.
No base cider.
No base cider.
Okay, yeah.
I've done Blenheim Orange. This past year's was Margill. Next year's will be Roxbury Russet.
Nice.
So I've got a theme going there, and it means I don't have to apply for another label approval.
So. Brilliant. Yeah. It's smart way to go. Right. Sure. You know, where you want to spend your time. So this is something that folks will be able to find at your cidery and in some local shops in Wisconsin. How far out is your product available?
Some products make it coast to coast. I am one of the domestic ciders, probably the one of the first domestic ciders in the Shelton Brothers portfolio.
Yeah, Shelton They're Brothers importers.
Importers, Shelton, yes. Yeah. I knew some of the crew there from, you know, from being in the Chicago market, going to things places mm-hmm. like the Great Taste of the Midwest, mm-hmm. and I knew Tom Oliver, you know, from the UK. And when they started importing his, they both asked me separately for advice on label approval.
Right.
So when they brought Tom's in, they brought mine in as kind of a, well, here's the. There's domestic craft cider too, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. small, you know, farm cider, small nice. Orchard-driven cider.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have a full life, and I don't do as much, you know, out in the field marketing as I should. But you know, we are sprinkled from California to DC.
Yeah, great, great to know that. This next bottle here is a brut. It's a sparkling cider. Is this made in like that traditional method, or is it?
It is. And it the Brut was their first cider
so
out the door.
Corked.
This is what we made in 2001.
Wow. Wow, no kidding.
It is zero residual sugar, right? There, mm-hmm. and it is fermented to dryness in the tanks, bulk tanks.
Mm-hmm.
We sterile filter it. We introduce, well, we sweeten it to get the amount of carbonation that we want, and I aim for about 6 volumes for this product.
Mm-hmm.
And we sterile filter it, we introduced encapsulated yeast, and we put it in the 18 bushel apple bins, mm-hmm. and we set those, you know, aside in our, we call it the cave. It's a double insulated room in the cidery. And 2 months later, at least, we pull them back out. Using the encapsulated yeast means that when it comes to the riddling and disgorging, where we settle mm-hmm. the yeast back down into the neck and then use the pressure in the bottle to blow it back out, mm-hmm. The riddling step with the encapsulated yeast takes a little bit less than 15 seconds. So that is a dramatic improvement on 2 weeks of turning the bottles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is what we did when we started out.
Right.
My father-in-law and I home-built a gyro pallet.
Wow.
And so we could turn about 300 bottles at once.
Fantastic. So again, for listeners out in Ciderville, this is a beautiful presentation. It's in a champagne bottle. Has a nice gold kind of a cap over the cork, a wire underneath that. And the actual label, it says Appley Sparkling Cider, but Appley Brut. This is a 7%. Beautiful, again, label with an apple blossom.
Yep, those,
yeah, flower.
That label is what we tend to use as a logo.
Okay.
The hand-painted apple blossoms and leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And very subtly, the background image, if you look, see the tree trunk there? Right
yes,
here,
yeah,
there's
yeah.
another tree trunk.
Yeah,
this is actually
yeah.
a filtered photo of part of the orchard with the background hills.
Okay. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really nice. So, what would one expect drinking that? What kind of profile?
It is crisp, mineral. It's rather tart, being a zero residual sugar.
Mm-hmm.
It is not overly sharp. Part of my philosophy in winemaking is a little bit more of an English West Country approach, except for the wild fermentation part.
Mm.
I balance my blends. I create my blends to be lower acidity than I hear people around me talking about. I run to the highest pH that people tend to be comfortable with. Mm. I'm on the high pH side. Little lower titratable acidity, mm-hmm. but that means when I have no added sugar, you know, at finishing, zero residual sugar, it's not a metallic, the the malic acid bite isn't metallic. It's mm-hmm. just tart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? It's not overly sharp.
Sure.
So this has a little earthy character, a little mineral character. People compare it to a Spanish cava.
Oh, all right. Right. Yeah.
And it is nice. Very champagne-y.
Wonderful, wonderful. So that champagne, you're going to have those very smaller bubbles that people would get in like a forced carbonated cider. Again, two beautiful bottles, beautiful presentation. These are standard ciders that you make every year. I mean, knowing that that's a barrel series, but this Appley Brew is something that is a yearly.
Yes.
Yearly,
yes.
So folks could get that.
The Americana is becoming annual as mm-hmm. the trees get big enough so that I can, you know, so the last couple of years, each year I've got had enough to make two barrels, actually. So.
Wonderful. You have a tasting room at your location
we
so
do.
People could go, and do you have the cider on tap?
Not on tap.
Okay,
so it's all bottled.
All bottled. Are there other places where it's available on tap? I thought you had mentioned that there's somewhere that you do some draft or...
Southeast Wisconsin.
Okay.
Actually, I've seen it on tap in Seattle.
Ooh, cool.
But certainly in Madison, Wisconsin area, Lost Valley is Milwaukee's cider bar.
Okay.
It shows up now and again here in the Northman in Chicago.
Right, the cider bar in Chicago. And your tasting room is open year-round?
Seasonally.
Seasonally, okay.
All right. We are closed in the winter. We are on a farm in Wisconsin, and most years it's rather icy and slippery.
Mm.
So we may be there working on a weekend, but I would suggest calling ahead because
yeah.
in January, February, and Muduary, we are closed.
Mm-hmm.
weekends, May through December, mm-hmm. we're open, and we do 6 days a week in September and October.
Wow.
When the apples are in, it's crazy.
Yeah. Are all your ciders in like a 750 mil size? Is that
yes.
your standard? Okay.
Yes.
You also have a distillery. You distill.
Yes.
And you make an apple brandy.
We do apple brandy, pear brandy. If I luck into some fruit, I'll do other kinds of brandies. Barrel-aged peach brandy is an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we are working our way through plum. And we do a sorghum-based whiskey.
Sorghum-based whiskey. Interesting. Yeah.
So I do not intentionally get on the gluten-free bandwagon, but when asked, the only gluten in the building is in the crackers.
Perfect. And is your apple brandy available also in distribution via the Shelton Brothers?
It is, actually.
Okay, great.
We're all low on stock right now. In fact, I don't have any. It will be at Cider Summit on the weekend.
Okay.
And we had to get it in from Shelton because I'm out. I'm in
wow.
between barrels.
Wow, wow.
My apple brandy is it's a little more barrel forward. I put it into a new charred barrel, like a bourbon would get. So
how long does it age for? The
just 8 months.
Just 8 months, okay.
Just 8 months.
Yeah. Wonderful. And that's kind of a problem, but it's a good problem to have because it says that you're selling out of all your stock, which...
Last fall, I ran in a price point experiment and found the right price point,
mm-hmm.
but the right price point also ran me out. Yes.
Yeah. Well, great. And you also have Perry.
I think I may be a better Perry maker than a cider maker.
Well, why don't we talk about that a little bit? Why would that be?
Go get Perry. We're starting to talk about Perry pears now.
Perry, you want to come listen? They're starting to talk about pears now.
Oh, I am listening. I'm in the Barca Lounger right now with a glass of Perry by my side. Go ahead. Continue on. I'm right there with you.
Those pears.
Hey, Palms. Now, everybody, quiet on the set. We're going to get into the pears. I know you've been waiting for this. Just hang tight, okay? Here we go.
Maybe it's because I like Perry.
Well, that's a good place to start.
Partly yeah. because maybe it's because I get a little better awards on my Perry. I help train the judges for the nation's biggest hard cider competition, but that doesn't mean I actually score well in said competition.
Mm-hmm.
Still working on that.
Yeah.
but my Perry gets a little better reception. I mean, I think I make a good cider.
Yeah.
And I do bow to the market, and I make some spiced ciders and some flavored ciders. Okay. So I do make modern ciders. Mm-hmm. I don't make just art ciders. Mm-hmm. I love art ciders, but I do have to make more than that. Mm-hmm. Perry is its own thing. It's mostly like making cider. There are a couple of quirks, but the real Perry pears are just wonderful. And there are so few of us doing it.
Yeah.
You know, in this country, there are so few of us doing it that I think I am actually, you know, I know my competitors, and I make a darn good Perry.
So what is the difference when one is working with pears versus ciders? Is there anything to kind of watch out for? Because I know a lot of ears are probably craning right now, listening, and saying, oh, Perry, what can you lend us with that?
Let us break Perry into two camps for a moment.
Sure.
Perry made with pears that you can buy at the store.
Culinary pears, we typically call them.
I say dessert pears.
Okay.
I use culinary for baking.
All right.
All right. And there used to be culinary pears.
What would be a typical dessert pear, name of a dessert pear?
Basque, Camas, Danjou, Bartlett.
Okay.
Right. There used to be, historically, there were baking pears, just like there are eating apples and baking apples and cider apples. Mm-hmm. There was such a thing as a baking pear, and only once has an audience stood up and corrected me when I have said they are extinct. And that was at a meeting of Slow Food Arc of Taste fruit growers.
And they said, we have them. Oh, me.
So...
Cool.
But in general, you know, I tend to lump, when it comes to cider pairing making, I lump eating and baking into one category.
Sure.
And purpose grown for cider making into the other.
Sure.
And as a chemist, the difference is tannins.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Eating and cooking are roughly 300 ppm, and drinking is grown only for drinking is... The English material says more than 2,000 ppm.
PPM stands for?
Parts per million. But if you see it as 0.2%,
that's the same. We're talking parts per million of what?
Polyphenols.
Polyphenols, okay.
Right.
Okay.
So, yeah. Your epicatechins, your fluorotin, chlorogenic acid, and your procyanidins would be what you have in cider and Perry. The eating, there are a few rare eating and cooking apples in the American portfolio, like Margill, like Arkansas Black, that stand out. They're like 900 ppm. But they're still not the minimum 2000 that the English use as the boundary line. In the U.S., we probably should adjust that 2,000 number downward a little bit, because in our climate, nobody reporting numbers reports the English numbers. We all report about half, and my own measurements are the same.
Is this the same apple, too?
Same apple. You measure Kingston Black, and you look at, say, Andrew Lee's cider-making website, and he'll list it at a certain PPM, and you delve into the databases for the USDA, and you look at the numbers that Gregory Peck is reporting, and they're all half.
From Cornell University, Gregory Peck. So that is telling us that's the terroir there that is impacting.
I think it's the sun.
The sun.
I think we have sunnier summers. My personal opinion, we have sunnier summers. We get more aroma, less tannin. Okay. They're cloudier. They get more tannin, less aroma.
Interesting. Okay.
So we were talking about Perry and dividing Perry pears into eating pears. Eating pears are very low acidity. Yeah, you can get a Basque with about 1 gram per liter titratable acidity and a pH of about 4.2, which would make most wine, if not higher. And that would make most wine makers and cider makers rightfully nervous. So you do an acid correction, whether you do it with a mix of malic acid or citric acid. Kind of depends on your own taste and what if somebody has, who is knowledgeable of the regulations and the TTB instructs you a certain way. In any case, you do an acid adjustment, and the size of the acid adjustment throws home brewers. As I have in my day job, I had a fellow home brewer who is very good. He got award-winning sour beers and is a lovely producer, and he wanted to make Perry for his wife. And so I ran him through the basics. So let's bring the titratable acidity up to at least between 3 and 4. You know, you'll get less chance of infection. You know, if you do sulfite, at pH 4, sulfite doesn't do anything at all. You might as well not add it. It's simply inactive at that pH. So let's get the pH down a little bit, bring your acidity up. And
is this with dessert pears now?
Dessert pears. Dessert pears.
Okay.
This is what most people are going to have access to, unless you're growing peri pears.
Yeah.
You're unlikely to get
that.
Somebody to sell them to you.
Yeah.
If you can, then good for you. And let me know who they are. So working with the dessert pears, Bartlett's, Bosque.
Yeah.
I like Camas pear. I think it has beautiful aroma. The pH is so high, you have to deal with it, or you have no shelf stability. And even the yeast, even regular wine yeast, can be cranky and do some strange things on you as they try to fix the pH to something that they like, given the substrate that they're in. Like producing a lot of volatile acidity. So the first thing is the acid correction, and the size of the acid correction of several grams per liter. If you're a home brewer and you're my friend would adjust the pH of his mineral water and the minerals, you adjust the pH, and he was used to adding, you know, fractions of a teaspoon per gallon, and he said he felt like he measured it out on a scale and said it felt like he was shoveling it in.
Interesting.
For a 5-gallon batch is 20 liters.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, times 3 is lots of grams. The next thing...
So that's the scary thing that you think.
That's
a lot
scary
of people, like,
thing.
They don't appreciate
the size. If they're used to brewing beer and say, okay, I know how to do a pH correction.
Right.
The size of the correction on Perry is big. The next thing would be nutrition. Apples have a reputation for having low assimilable nitrogen. Pears are lower. So, especially if you're in the home brewing school that does a very managed approach, like some of the Midwest mead makers do, a really at this pH and this time add this nutrient, this much of this nutrient. They have a very, you know, very specific process they work through. Or even if you're just taking the guidelines of something like Scott Labs and Shea Comfort.
Right.
You know, the recommended starting nitrogen levels, maybe several hundred ppm nitrogen, and Perry might cut. Pears vary a lot. The ones I get locally are going to come in about 20 ppm, which is a huge difference.
Yeah.
And if you're doing an unfed method, because I try to control fermentation speed by nutrition rather than refrigeration, then you have to mind that very carefully, because unhappy yeast are smelly yeast. So the first thing you're going to notice is that your pears, your fermenting dessert pears, they're going to want to make H2S. The whole point of that part of the story was that pears are really H2S prone.
Interesting.
The next thing is, if you like a clear one, a clear product, they're very hard to clear. They don't respond well to bentonite. You know, for fining agents, they can just be devilishly hard to clear. And sometimes I've even given up. It is partly the less oxygen exposure you have, the better. Because I've had traditional Perry, you know, not 300 ppm, but 3,000 ppm polyphenols, gallic acid equivalents, if you really want the number. I've had them go unfilterable. Right, the haze goes through a 0.45 micron membrane filter.
Wow. So you just lend yourself that it could be a cloudy Perry.
I figured out what was doing it. It was oxygen exposure, and I stopped it.
When you say oxygen, are we still using these stainless steel barrels?
But they have breathing bungs.
And it's just that amount. Just that amount. So let's say we have somebody who does have a peri pear tree or a culinary, whatever. Well, not whatever, but they're making that in like a 5-gallon glass carboy or a 3-gallon.
I think they should just send their pears to me.
Well, that said, that's true.
You know, during fermentation, it's not too bad. Right? Okay. It's really during storage.
So what would you do? I mean, like with cider, you have like a half inch or something between there and the cork, and you know, not so much, or an inch.
Make sure that you have a good seal. So maybe around that stopper, maybe use electrical tape around the stopper.
Wow.
Never let it dry out, and
coat it with CO2 or something like that.
You could CO2 blanket it, or argon. You know, from the little wine.
Yeah.
You know, you can get the say wine saver.
Sure,
you could argon will be a better blanket than CO2 will. It's heavier, it settles.
Okay, settles onto it. Okay.
CO2 will diffuse up and fill the whole volume. Argon is much heavier than air, so it'll settle to the bottom.
Fantastic. Good tip.
And don't try to skimp on the sulfite. You don't have to go heavy. But know your pH and make the right adjustment.
I'm thinking about, you know, a lot of the home cider makers. And so if they were going to just kind of ballpark it and they don't really know their pH, I mean, can you just make it without pH and knowing all that and kind of testing that? Or it's not worth it? You really need to
you can do it. No, you can make it. Besides, a person like that probably isn't going to care about the cloudiness.
That's right.
For them, it's avoiding the H2S and smelling it every morning during the primary fermentation.
Yeah.
And if it starts to smell bready and then eggy and then meaty and then, well, sorry, meaty and then eggy and then rotten eggy, you know, somewhere when it's eggy, add a quarter dose of Fermade, right? DAP.
Good.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't add a lot. I for 5 gallons, I'd be adding it
a quarter.
I look at the recommended dose and I put at a quarter at a time.
And let that sit for?
It should clear up the H2S in an hour or less.
Okay.
And then don't add more until it asks for more. It will ask by smelling. I've listened to Shea Comfort, the Yeast Whisperer, over the years and learned many things. I apply them differently. He says, your yeast are your rock stars. Give them a great hotel to feel happy in. I say, your yeast are rock stars. Make them sleep in the back of the van like any other rock star.
All right. Okay. So with the making the Perry, the length of time from start to finish, just the same as you would kind of regulate that with cider?
Yes.
Same thing. So you're pressing in the fall. You're kind of conditioning it through.
Quickest I can do is about 4 months.
4 months, okay.
I like, if I can get the primary fermentation from when I pitch to when white cap falls. Right? That is how I define my primary fermentation. If that is 2 to 3 weeks, I'm happy.
All right.
And that's in a 500-gallon size.
500-gallon. And are you doing the yeast the same way you did that, like as you mentioned, in the still cider?
Dry pitched on top, let it take its time. You bet.
Okay. And any recommendations on yeast there?
Without giving away what I use, I've tried 20-some. If I tend to ignore the recommendation for what this yeast is for.
Yeah.
I do use wine yeast rather than ale yeasts, partly from what I see and experience in other people's ciders who do use ale yeasts. Please don't ever use Nottingham ale yeast.
In
cider, it tends to make ridiculous amounts of volatile acidity.
Okay.
You know, ethyl acetate bombs. Ethyl acetate's so strong that it smells like a baking spice, but you dilute it back and poof, you're back to VA.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have some Nottingham cider. I've never tried it before. I said, I finally want to use some, you know, English ciders. Let me try that and made a batch.
Well, that's an ale yeast, not a cider yeast anyway. So, you know, the white labs or the white yeast, their cider yeasts are good. I like the slowest fermentation. I find that the recommendation for, you know, if you're reading the descriptions, if it has the beta-glucosidase that is supposed to release glucose molecules from terpenes, which are aroma precursors, right, to liberate the ripened aroma. Apples don't have terpenes, or at least very rarely do they have terpenes, so it seems to make a small difference, but very small difference. If I'm lucky and I'm working with apples with tannins, right, yeast that say develop the complex polysaccharides, that's good, right? Those really work well with the apple tannins. It makes them less biting, right, and more astringent. Right, more of a velvety astringent rather than a dandelion sap astringency.
Right.
So that's good. Slow.
Slow. What temperature?
Well, like I say, I pitch at 35, but my fermentation temperature is usually probably about 60.
60. Okay.
Fahrenheit.
That's about the same that most folks are typically trying to reach for.
I started with commercial dairy tanks, use dairy tanks, and they're insulated. Milk tanks, and my fermentations would go up to about 85.
Wow.
Yeah, but nobody ever noted that they thought my ciders tasted hot.
Did you?
No. But remember, I was doing the bottle conditioning, so they were getting a second fermentation at a lower temperature, and I think that was doing something.
Little trick there. Huh?
Yeah. So. The low and slow is my motto with cider and fermentation, fermenting cider and Perry. The one thing I found wildly inaccurate in the yeast guides is the nitrogen requirement. That is something that if you're experimenting with yeasts, you just have to experiment your way through. And some yeasts are known to, if you don't feed them enough, they like to make H2S. I avoid that. I'm not the kind of person who says, it'll blow off. No, let's just not have it to begin with. Pears especially are susceptible to making diethyl disulfide. And at very low levels, you may not be able to taste it, but it will ding the pear aroma. It just subtracts from the aroma before you ever recognize it. So I avoid sulfides. And I do that by careful fermentation management.
So but no
I
sulfites have at all?
What?
No sulfites at all?
I said IDE. IDE.
Okay, all right. Sulfide.
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 Avoiding sulfide. Yeah, that's my pet peeve. You know, keep your number of electrons straight. It's IT, I-T-E is one thing, and IDE is a different. So... some yeast will adapt to a low nitrogen strategy, some won't. Some will adapt as long as they always see what they started in. Right? So once you start feeding them, they're addicted. If you start them at high nitrogen, because you added the fermate and things like that up front for them to start, plan on keep feeding them. Right. And that is where, because I use strains that the catalog says requires a lot of nitrogen. And if I never give it nitrogen, it never asks for it. But if I give it nitrogen to start, it keeps wanting more. And that actually, the reasons why are, again, listen to the Yeast Whisperer. He has great explanations about why that's true. I just... I see the same information and I use it differently.
Yeah, very interesting. Because there's probably a lot of people listening right now who are like, oh darn, why did I start that?
You know, making nice cider to drink is really quite easy, especially if you like it dry. It's easy to get into cider making. Making the finest ciders, that can get into fruit sourcing, and that can be hard just because it's hard to get your hands. To me, you don't make you make fine cider out of fine apples. There's simply no substitution. You can't readily get apple polyphenolics to add to cider. Like, you can add oak tannins and you can add grape tannins, but the chemical structures and the organoleptic properties of those are different. You can tell. Right, so as long as you're into cider that's subtle and tart, it's easy to make a nice cider at home.
What would your advice people look for when when sipping a Perry, because a lot of people don't really know. You know, we're just kind of starting getting folks to know what to look for with cider.
Okay. First thing, Perry will never be as dry as cider. Even if it's not sweetened, even a zero residual sugar Perry will have a certain amount of sorbitol in it, because pears have a sugar apple that is a sugar alcohol that is unfermentable by yeast, right? Okay. Sorbitol. So it varies. It appears to vary by cultivar, and it appears to vary either by year or by orchard management practice. Mm-hmm. I've seen some really strange things. So if you're fermenting Perry, it won't go below 1 on a specific gravity. It just won't.
Good to know, because somebody might expect it to.
Right. Cider will go below 1. Yeah. Dry cider will be, 0.995, good, whatever. Good. Perry won't. Yeah. It'll always hold at like 101.2 or, 101.
Right. And we're talking about specific gravity.
Yes. I don't think in Play-Doh.
Anybody listening here, yeah, just trying to catch up.
I read a lot of wine books, so I think in bricks. One, it won't go as dry. Mm-hmm. If you're working with eating pears, it's like a light, delicate white wine. It can be floral. It tends to be floral, mm-hmm, right? A little perfumey. Bartlett will have recognizable varietal that makes it through. It's got a decanoic acid as one of its aroma molecules that will escape fermentation. Other pear varieties won't be as recognizable as the fresh fruit. Maybe even less so than apples. And it's hard to get varietal character through an apple fermentation. Bartlett will get through. It should be soft, right? Even a dry Perry will be, a semi-dry at most. It can be fruity. It's an alternative to white wine. As I just mentioned, it's hard to kind of get away. It's really similar.
Yeah.
I find that it's easier to sell expensive Perry than it is to sell expensive cider. Pears have as much mystery and mystique as grapes. Mm-hmm. Apples are too mundane. I think they're cool. I'm an apple snob,
sure,
but in the wider market, it's a little easier to sell a pricey Perry, I find, than to sell a pricey cider. If you have the Perry fruit, then expect tannins. The pear will be pear, but it's not Bartlett. Perry pears have an almost hint of a tropical and pine note to them, mm-hmm, that is very distinctive. English Perry should be much less phenolic and wild than the English cider. French Perry is very rare. Poiré is very rare. It's out there. It tends to be a little bit more like American and a little bit more like made with eating pears. The tannins, right, in pears, the real Perry pears, mm-hmm, are papery, right? So it has this... a paper-like astringency and a paper-like taste, mm-hmm, that lingers. Yeah. Pear aftertaste lingers, and it has a little bit of like a spiced baked pear aftertaste that will linger a long time. Mm-hmm. And that is true whether it is a pear wine, a fortified pear, which ours is called Poirissimo, it's the pear version of Pommeau, or a pear brandy. That aftertaste, mm-hmm, component survives distillation.
So let's just say, so your Perissimo,
yes,
is you made the pear, the Perry.
It's pear juice and pear brandy.
Okay.
At about 20% alcohol.
All right.
It's, oh my God, it's a pear.
Yeah. Is that aged in...
No.
Barrels?
Just steel. It's not aged in wood. Just,
no, okay,
again, trying to protect it from oxidation.
Right.
Keeping a lighter color, keeping my delicate fresh fruit.
Mm-hmm. How old are the pear trees that you're working with, and the Perry pear trees that you're working with?
We planted them in 2004.
So they're
so a
really
couple of them are a little
trees.
Older than that.
Yeah, yeah.
And this year I got, and people are going to laugh, big cider producers are going to laugh, I got about 400 gallons of Perry juice this year, the most I've ever had.
But I'm sure you were happy as a pig in mud. Who wouldn't be? You know, I mean, that's incredible. You know, it's interesting, having been over to Normandy and speaking with Eric Bordelais, you know, he'll say that a pear tree doesn't make a good pear until it's about 100 years old.
I haven't been around long enough to speak to age of trees. In general, I'm skeptical. Prove it to me. That said, the Cortland apples I get from another orchard on the Lake Michigan shore that are, you know, 70-year-old trees are really nice, really perfumed. I really like that. But I don't know how much of that is just the lake shore effect and how much of it is age. And besides, at 80 years, they aren't going to be around much longer. Right? Because apple trees don't live that long, at least not in this continent.
Yeah, not too long, but pear trees can live quite a long
time. Yes, they can.
No doubt about that. And you're planting more pear trees? Is that something that you do? Or
right now we're trying to figure out, the orchard owners are getting on. They want to retire, and we have to spend a year or so figuring out what our future is before we can put more pears in the ground. They actually hate them with a passion. They're relatively low yield per acre, so as for sheer fruit growing economics, right? They're prone to fire blight, so we've lost half of the ones we planted until we figured out which ones are especially susceptible. They have odd growth patterns, so they're a little harder to train. Many of them have even come to pruning it in the winter. So a number of them have bud scales, right? These are the covers, the oblong covers that cover the little flower and leaves in the bud, right? And an apple tree, they're this little thing the size of a ladybug, and there's a little round bump on the end of the spur, right? And on peri pears, it's an inch and a half long with a point so sharp it'll go through a leather glove.
Wow.
So they're hard trees just to be around.
Yeah.
The branches are very stiff, so when you go up on the ladder they don't dwarf for beans. So when you go up on the ladder to get those top yellow huff caps,
it could hurt.
And you push an elbow into a branch to push it aside, you know, it may shove you back off the ladder.
Yeah. They have
actually
personality.
It will go through your coat at the same time.
Oh,
so
those peri pears.
So, but the flavor is just so incredible.
Yeah.
Charles McGonigal will be with us in the next upcoming episode, number 84, speaking on sensory analysis and how he conducts a workshop on this topic for judges and for cider makers at CiderCon. So do subscribe to this podcast so you could get in on that. Obviously, Charles is very passionate and is just filled with so much great info. If you want to see the show notes to this episode, go to episode number 83 at ciderchat.com. And if you're a patron, you will be getting a transcript that will go to the Cider Chat Patreon page, and you'll be able to download that all on the portion of this episode where he was speaking on Perry. And he certainly gave us a lot of value and content to ponder and to really help our own cider making techniques.
Rhea.
Yes, Perry.
I think that there's only one thing you need to put in the transcript that you'll be giving to the patrons of Cider Chat, and that's this following segment. Can you cue it up, Mr. Quince?
Counting 1, 2, 3.
But the flavor is just so incredible.
Yeah.
I would call that what we say in podcast land, a wrap, wouldn't you, Rhea?
Yeah, I think that was pretty perfect. A nice way to end this segment. But I do think that the folks at the Patreon page are going to want a little bit more. You know, Charles did speak quite broadly on the quirks on dealing with a peri pear.
I think, Rhea, what Charles was attempting to say there is that a peri pear must be treated with its rightful respect in its place within palms. And we can't help it if we're a little bit bothered by orchardists who don't understand our individual needs and who are a bit of a bugger when they're climbing up in the tree. We only poke when poked.
But Perry, you said yourself that you only let Rhea climb up in the tree and pick the Perry pears. Anyone else, you're going to give them a good little shot in the arm.
Well, Rhea, I think it's time to move on. Don't you agree? We need to speak about the two pairs of tickets that are being given away to the Cider Circus for August 26th in Colorado.
Nice, Perry. Very nice segue. Yes, there are two pairs of tickets to give away to the Cider Circus in Colorado. If you want to hear more about that and the folks behind it, go to episode number 81 with the Gypsy Cider Circus based in Tennessee. Every year, they put on the Cider Circus at the Copper Mountain Ski Resort in Colorado. It's about an hour and a half outside of Denver, and it's going to be another fantastic year. So if you'd like to get in on that, it's really easy. All you have to do is subscribe to eCider News at ciderchat.com. There'll be a link to that in the show notes. And the two winners for the two pairs of tickets for the first pour will be picked on July 1st. So you might not live out in Colorado. You might not be heading there this summer, but I bet you know someone who is out in that area and might really like this really great treat. So check it out at ciderchat.com where it says subscribe to eCider News. And that's going to be a newsletter that will be going out giving you updates about Cider Chat and some of the new projects I have in the loop. So check it out there at ciderchat.com. Well, I look forward to hanging out with you next week when we have Charles McGonigal back on talking about sensory analysis and the classes that he teaches at CiderCon and GlintCap. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast and also share it. Tell your friends about the Cider Chat. That really makes a difference. And boy, people don't really know that there's a cider podcast out there yet. So you can do your part for Ciderville. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!